Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe from joecolantonio.com. And if you're like me, one of the biggest problems with learning Selenium is all the various information you need to piece together in order to get started. It's really easy to get frustrated and filled up with information overload, and at the end, making no progress with learning Selenium. So I used to always wish that there was a quick jumpstart guide that could get me started with test automation without all the bells and whistles. Then I discovered the Selenium Guidebook by Dave Hefner. It's a concise, good practice approach to learning Selenium quickly. There's also different packages you could purchase to accelerate your learning process even quicker with tip sheets and videos and, of course, the guidebook itself. The Selenium Guidebook Ruby Edition has been around for a few years, but hot off the presses, Dave has just released the Selenium Guidebook Java Edition. So if you really want to learn Selenium in 2016 or pick up a new tip or trick, you definitely need to check out the Selenium Guidebook and this episode. So check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Dave. Welcome back to Test Talks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to finally have you back on the show. You were in episode 2, so it's been quite a while. So what have you been up to since last time we spoke?
Oh, man. A lot of stuff. I've been to a lot of countries talking about Selenium and consulting with companies to kind of see what they've been doing with Selenium. And it's really been kind of a fascinating set of experiences. Mainly the company visits. I spent some time in Israel and got to meet with a bunch of companies and see companies at different levels of maturity and see some ones with just really fascinating implementation of Selenium, really robust, really mature, really dialed in, and some very non-obvious uses of Selenium. Like I saw one company that was using it for doing monitoring for their website. Just some really interesting use cases. But and I've also so I released a second edition of my book. Nice. So I branched out from Ruby into Java, and it was something I was doing. I started before I started traveling overseas for Selenium stuff, but it was kind of really confirmed and driven home how widespread Java is with regards to Selenium. Every company, with like one exception, used Java for Selenium. And then since then I've looked up all the download numbers for Selenium across all the programming languages, and Java owns this year something like 65% of the downloads for Selenium.
Wow. Yeah, I agree with that. It seems that everyone seems to be using Java, and it's just a lot easier when you're Googling issues because most people are using Java to find ways to fix whatever you may be encountering. So I find that helpful in that case. But I also like your point of view that you have also, where if you're developers, you don't necessarily need to use the same exact language as your developers. Do you still believe that? Or what are your thoughts now that you know that Java is one of the main language bindings that most people use?
I still think that my stance from when I spoke last time and what I've written about, it still holds true that who's owning it is what matters. And I've also seen an explosive growth in JavaScript usage. Mm. So companies with mature implemented Java frameworks leaning into the thought of rewriting things into JavaScript. And that's because the front-end developers are showing a real interest now that Node.js came on the scene, and that's gaining a lot of popularity. And there's a bunch of different WebDriver libraries in Node that people are really excited about. And so I met with a bunch of companies that have also expressed interest in that. And that's showing that, you know, it was a different perspective than what I had thought. I mean, originally it was people who aren't programmers trying to learn to program. And then that's where that original argument came from. And now seeing the people who are owning it are people who are building the front ends, and then they're excited about testing. And of course you would want to encourage and nurture that.
Right.
So that's been really interesting, because I think that This year alone, the JavaScript downloads for Selenium I think they eclipsed all prior years combined.
Wow.
So it's, and that's making, I think that's the number two, JavaScript's number two in terms of downloads this year.
Wow. So would you think that the reason for that is this year? Is it because of Protractor or the adoption of AngularJS? I've been hearing more and more about JavaScript. I know it's very popular, but I can't stand writing in JavaScript. But what are your thoughts around that?
I don't know the breakdown across all libraries, but I do think that I think that there is just more and more JavaScript all the time now. Yep. More so every year, and then the fact that there are people who have turned their eye towards WebDriver and made some libraries that are approachable probably helps. And then the fact that, yeah, there's Angular, there's Protractor, there's things like that, that probably all helps. And if that's back-ended by the same library that you could just write straight Selenium tests with instead of having this nice layer on top of it, that works too. I would assume it's that. Or it's just like the JavaScript community, front-end community is just catching up and saying, hey, this is actually really cool.
Right.
So it could just be that, they got a taste for it and now it's just getting, passed around as like a cultural expected thing. Just like how within Ruby, testing is a part of the culture. Now it's like with JavaScript, we're using Node, it's like, well, using Selenium is easy and it should be done. It's cool. So
yeah, it's interesting. I guess I work for a large company and our front-end developers, they use JavaScript, they use AngularJS. So they wanted to write the framework in Java, but most of the other developers write in Java, not JavaScript. So I didn't know, do I have two frameworks, one in JavaScript, one in Java? So it's always a fine line between, do I just let them create whatever they're going to create because we're going to get better testing, or do we just say, let's all go around one tool, one framework, and that's what we're going to use?
Yeah, I think that's a real tough thing to figure out, and I've seen a couple companies navigate that, and I don't think that they figured out a good answer yet. And, I think I've seen, there was a talk at SeleniumConf in Portland earlier this year. I think it was about having kind of a testing as a service, almost like a REST endpoint that could receive a wire protocol from WebDriver and execute tests on a infrastructure of grid nodes and how it didn't really matter what language you wrote it in, and it would just receive it. And they did some clever stuff, but it was interesting to think like, oh, well, what if you did have multiple languages, but one, kind of one way to execute them all, and then as long as you can kind of aggregate the results in the reports. And the hard part, I think, is just making sure that the feature set across languages is consistent, because that's always the big issue with rewrite, is that you end up with things that are doing things differently. Yep. And if you have someone move from one team to another, like, that's just not something that's conducive for growth ultimately.
Awesome. So it just seems like you mostly were working in Ruby, and it sounds like you've just started implementing Java. I'm pretty sure you're going to implement every language binding for your Selenium guidebook. So have you learned anything specifically about Java, though, as you were working on Java that you didn't know about?
I don't know if there's anything specific about Java other than I guess I had this, since I came to test automation not as a programmer, like I really had very limited programming background that, and I spent so much time in Ruby that I was kind of, I guess, innately afraid of Java and like compiled languages, because it seemed like extra, very verbose and had all these other requirements. You have to deal with compilers and you really need an IDE to use it well. And then after I got into it, it was like, oh, this is actually pretty straightforward, especially with an IDE, because it just does so much of the hard part for you. The thing I would say is that it was actually a nice break from spending so much time in a dynamically typed scripting language where everything is an object to a very explicit, strongly typed language that's compiled. What it's doing. Whereas in Ruby, if you if inadvertently somehow the type of an object gets changed, that object becomes that new type, but there's no way to really know. And so you could have a really pernicious bug in your test code and not realize it, and finding it could be hard. But mm-hmm. in Java, it's like, well, it just won't run. It's like, and it will tell you where it's broken. and it'll probably tell you where it's broken as you type. And so I just really appreciated that. I think it made things a fair bit easier, and that you can work past the verbosity of things pretty quickly, because you end up gaining a lot of insight into exactly what a test is supposed to be doing.
Awesome. Yeah, you actually have a pretty good video on YouTube where I forget where what conference it is. I think it was in Russia, where you talk about building a maintainable, reliable framework in Selenium using Java, and it was really, I thought it was really good. So I'll include that in the show notes. But so I guess my question was, one of the things that came out of that was you mentioned something about JUnit rules. What's a JUnit rule?
Oh yeah, okay. I'm refreshing my memory because when I released updated editions of my book, and I started with Java, then ended with Ruby. So oh. I got Ruby on the brain. Let me give myself a refresher. So there's two things that I use that I think are lesser known or just not, you know, enjoyed for use. And so there's the JUnit rules, and then there were categories. And so JUnit rules are what I used. They're basically built-in functionality that exists within JUnit that enables you to do extra things like storing the setup and teardown actions in different places. And so when I end up creating this framework that I talk about in my book, and then I've talked about it in various talks and at workshops at conferences, was that you want to have a way to abstract your setup and teardown and have it fire before your test, but in your test still have access to the before annotation so that if you wanted to, you could create an instance of a page object and have it receive a driver object. So if you, and you know, the first obvious abstraction would be if you have a test and it has a before and after annotation, you can create a base utility class for your tests that then your test classes would inherit. And so then you would just move that before block into your base test. But what happens is that before annotation in the base test fires, but kind of stomps on what's happening in the test. And so then you can't really create a page object, and it ends up creating either a race condition or just doesn't work condition. And so then by using a JUnit rule, it kind of works around everything, where you can have a JUnit rule that handles external resources JUnit rule, and it has a method that you can overload called before and a method you can overload called after. And what these do is these actually fire prior to the JUnit annotations for before and after. So you can end up basically creating an instance of Selenium in this base test class. And then in your test that inherits from the base test, you can end up getting access to this before annotation and keep your setup method and create an instance of a page object, receive the driver object that was created by this JUnit rule. And then everything just does the right thing.
Awesome. Yeah, I never knew about it. I've been using Java for a while now in my framework. So that was kind of cool to find out more about. And also, you mentioned base class. Base object. I think most people are familiar with a page object, but what is a base page object for people that don't know?
Yeah, so when I talked about this, every time it was like I'd get a percentage of the room that would like scratch their head just based on what I was calling it, and even the concept a little bit. But I started to like add additional names, so it's like base page object, a Selenium wrapper, a base utility class, I don't know the best way to just describe it so that everyone knows what it is. When you say plaid, everyone knows, oh, plaid, right. You know, flannel. Like, it's like, so basically it's the concept of taking the similar tenets that go into a page object. You know, it's like you would have your locators and the behavior of a page in an object, and you do the same thing, but with your Selenium actions. So instead of having them, you know, all throughout all of your page objects, you could take those Selenium actions that are common and put them into a class. And then the cool thing is that there's a couple benefits. You can start adding additional functionality in this one central place. Like if you have a method that's checking to see if something is displayed on the page and that thing isn't on the page, it's going to return an exception. So you can actually do a try catch to catch for a no such element exception and have it return false instead. So the method will say is displayed, and if it's there, it'll say true. And then if it's not there, it'll say false as opposed to exception. And so by doing that, you start to, you know, kind of bulletproof your Selenium usage a little bit, and then you update all your page objects so they're a bit more readable. And then if there were ever any API changes to Selenium, you just go to one place to change it. This is probably not super true of an issue for Selenium 3 coming at some point in the future. I don't know when, because of the W3C specification. But It's not like as big of a change as when they jumped from Selenium 1 to Selenium 2, right? We went from RC to WebDriver, and there was huge, huge changes. But I got this idea and this practice, I guess it's more of a pattern, from Jason Labia at SeleniumConf in Boston back in, what was that, like 2013?
13, yep.
And he gave a closing keynote talking about how at Google they use this pattern to migrate from RC to WebDriver. And they also did some stuff with WebDriver back Selenium within this pattern, but it made it super easy, because the other thing I didn't mention is you could actually pretty easily swap out the underlying automation framework with this pattern too, if you really wanted to. Like, you could actually just say, oh, I'm going to plug in something else that, you know, that will drive the browser, or and you just back in the actions for that framework into these methods that you create in the base class, and then that's pretty much it, assuming they of course use locators right. the same way. But yeah, I guess that's basically the gist of it. I was thinking in Ruby it was like you could use Selenium WebDriver, or then you could use something like Mechanize, and then that would just traverse and use locators the same way if you could find the commands to do the same things.
Cool. And what I love about this concept, I don't know if you've heard of HP's new LeanFT. The reason why I'm mentioning it, it's basically QTP, but it allows you to, through an API and SDK, create tests in C# or Java, pretty much like you do with Selenium, but allows you also to not only automate a browser, but also to automate the client applications. And like I said, I work for a big company, and we actually have a modern web application that integrates with thick client applications, and you can't automate with Selenium. So if we use some sort of base object, maybe in those instances, we can just switch it over to the LeanFT to handle it. But just a thought, thinking out loud.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I guess the big issue, the only real logistical hurdle I can foresee would be dealing with locators. And then, you know, in my book, I write about how you could create constants at the top of a page object to store the locators. And then the thing you could do differently would be just have, you know, capture those objects elsewhere. So then you can inject, is this a web page? Use these web elements. If it's a desktop, use these desktop elements, that kind of thing. But yeah, that sounds like a pretty cool setup.
So Dave, you also mentioned something about the Allure framework. And I never heard of it. So what is the Allure framework?
Yeah, so there's this company based out of Russia called Yandex, and they make some awesome stuff. That a lot of it's open source. And it's basically, I guess they build really cool software products, and then they happen to learn a lot, and then they package it up and open source it. So Yandex released what's called the Allure framework, which for those of you that don't know, it's basically a really awesome HTML report generator for Selenium tests, and it is platform agnostic, and there are bindings for most, like I think almost all, if not all by now, of the prominent testing frameworks for all prominent programming languages that are out there. And basically what it does is you plug it in to your test setup, and you just make it so you output XML from your test runs, just like you would do for continuous integration, into a directory. And then you also capture screenshots on failure, much like you would do for your test runs for any sort of framework. And then what you do after your tests run is you run this this binary that they have that will take those things and convert it to this standard schema that will then generate this HTML report that is like a full-blown Angular app. This just like really slick, like bells and whistles, HTML5. It just looks really good. And they take the screenshots and they make this really nice interactive report. And it's just like, it solved a real problem for the Selenium space, because most anyone that builds a framework realizes pretty quickly that they have to build their own HTML report generator if they want something better than just the standard kind of gnarly looking, not super helpful one that you can kind of generate with certain test tools that exist. And it just, they did it really well. And the fact that it works for everything is just kind of like mind-blowingly cool. And so I talked about that, and that's a really good one. And then some people might be familiar with Yandex through, they wrote this page object helper. I think for people that use Java, they're familiar with the Page Factory, which comes built into Selenium. But Yandex also created one called HTML Elements, which is like an even simpler, sleeker page object wrapper, basically. I don't use it, but I've heard really good things about it.
Awesome. Yeah, those two cool things I definitely didn't know about, and I'm definitely going to check out. I'm using something called Serenity to get that reporting, but it also adds extra things on top of that. And I guess there's pros and cons to that. Sometimes I don't know what it's doing in the background. So sometimes I'd rather just do a stripped down framework I created and just add in these extra things that do something specific, like reporting, rather than taking care of everything else behind the scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. Cause you could script it out pretty easily, and then you can have it just be sucked in as part of like a Jenkins test run for a job and as a final action. And then you have like a really robust report.
All right, Dave, I know we talked about a few times we mentioned your book, The Selenium Guidebook, but I've been hearing a lot of good things about it, that you're working on some new things. Can you just tell us a little bit more what you're doing with The Selenium Guidebook?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, I started in Ruby, then I wrote it in Java. In between those two things, I realized that just the book alone wasn't really enough as far as like making the material approachable. So I added some additional tiers that people can purchase, like the cheat sheets, and then, 2.5 hours of video walkthroughs. So very like designed to be as friendly for self-paced learning as possible. Earlier this year, released the Java edition, and then I just did an updated release recently, a couple weeks ago, and that was to update the Ruby edition so it's current with the current version of RSpec, and then updated the Java edition to make some tweaks based on feedback I got from Java developers, where they're like, you really shouldn't be using an interface like that. You should really be using a static class and like that kind of stuff. And then just general, bug fixes and that kind of thing. But the goal of the Selenium Guidebook is really, and also for my tip newsletter, Elemental Selenium, is to offer all of this content in every supported programming language for Selenium. And that's an exclusive for Test Talk listeners. This is the first place I think I've mentioned it this publicly.
Awesome.
But the goal is to branch out to cover every programming language. I get requests all the time for C#, for Python, for JavaScript, and those are the other supported languages that that I don't have that I think would be fantastic to offer to my readers and to everyone that's not currently a reader. And so basically, the way I was thinking about doing that was different than what I've done in the past. Traditionally, I would just do like some sort of pre-order to gauge demand to make sure it's really something that's interesting to people, and then do it, then launch it. And instead of that, like that's like one book a year probably, and it's a horrible pace. So I'm going to do a Kickstarter to basically put it all out there and say I'm going to do them all, and set like a reasonable goal for the Kickstarter campaign. And then assuming it's funded, then I'll do all of them. And I'll do them, hopefully before, the goal is early next year to launch the Kickstarter. And then the hope would be like a few months after the Kickstarter ends, I'd be able to just rock through all of them and get them out there. It takes about somewhere between, I haven't really done the math in a while, but it's like, I'd say I spent about 2 weeks figuring out the code examples, and probably another week before that, figuring out like understanding this programming language. And so that I don't understand. Then there's like a peer review cycle where I get a bunch of people to code review. So, and then I have to, then I'll write the book, then I'll make the cheat sheets, then I'll record the videos, and then I'll repeat. And so that's probably like a 6 week to 2 month window. So I'd say probably 6 months after the Kickstarter is done to get everything out the door, which is like a tremendous feat to accomplish, I think, considering I've only done one book a year for the last 2 years. So, but I think it'd be awesome. I think it'd be worth it. I think that it's exactly what is like, I've covered some of the need by covering Ruby and Java, but I think that there's still, over half of the languages that aren't covered. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Awesome. Yeah. I think it's a great resource. So if someone wants to learn more about the Selenium Guidebook, I'll have a link to it in the show notes, but is there a particular site you like people to go to find out more info and keep up to date on where your progress is with that Kickstarter program?
I'm at a loss considering I wasn't planning really to make an official announcement yet, but the easiest way, honestly, is to come to either of my websites, which is probably more than there should be, and basically sign up for something of mine, and then you'll get an announcement when things happen to go out for the Kickstarter. There will likely be kind of a lead up sequence going into it, just to tell people more about it. But the best places are, you just want to receive weekly tips on Selenium, go to elementalselenium.com. And if you're new to Selenium and you just want to figure out how to get started, you can go to elementalselenium.com/bootcamp. And then that's a sign up form to sign up for a free 5-day email course on how to use Selenium. And then as far as my book goes, there's a free sample available, and you just find out all you want to know by going to selenium guidebook.com. And about halfway down on the page is the free sample. And if you sign up for, you know, any of those things, you ultimately end up getting the weekly tip emails from me. And that's pretty much it. And so I guess I'd like to give a shout out just the fact that I actually recently got sponsors for those things as well, if that's all right.
Yeah, definitely.
So Sauce Labs is a sponsor of your show, is a sponsor of my newsletter. I'm really excited about that. I think they have a great product, and I hope they continue to have a great product.
So, love Sauce Labs.
Yeah. And then I signed on with Apple Tools as a sponsor recently. Nice. And for those of you that don't know, automated visual testing, or if you're really don't like the word testing for automation, automated visual checking. But basically, they are a SaaS app that makes automated visual testing easy and awesome. It's like, it's just as Sauce Labs makes it turnkey to get a infrastructure for Selenium, Apple Tools makes it so it's turnkey to use machine learning with computer vision to like just do, you know, visual layout testing and a whole bunch of other things. Just, it's fascinating. It's like, I spent the last year basically researching and writing about automated visual testing. And it's the one takeaway I have is the future is here. And for a few lines of code, you could be in the future too.
No, I totally agree. I love Apply Tools. I actually even love the owners of Apply Tools. Everyone I meet at Apply Tools is awesome. So I think that's a great recommendation. People should definitely check out visual validation testing. It actually picks up things that even our manual testers can't find. It's that good. So I'll second that recommendation.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah, so I'm pretty stoked about that. And yeah, those are the big things. I'm looking to offer more content around automated visual testing here soon. I might incorporate something into my book about it.
Thank you, Dave, for your Selenium Guidebook Automation Awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/85. And while you're there, make sure to click on the Sign Up Now button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, why not share it with a friend or coworker? And together, we can help spread automation awesomeness to the masses. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.